As you make your way down the street, a typical lane in the typical village of Rodmell in Sussex, you walk past a succession of cottages. They're mostly made of red bricks and are tucked behind flint walls and big bushes. They have typically English names like Spring Cottage or the Old Rectory. It's quiet, just the peaceful swaying of green trees and the distant sound of cattle. Then you reach the gates of Monk's House. Like the other houses and cottages, it's attractive but unassuming. But despite its unremarkable exterior, what went on inside Monk's House is remarkable. I'm Alison Steadman, and this is 125 Treasures, a podcast from the National Trust. Episode 4, The Writer on the Wall.
Stepping into Monk's House has been likened to stepping into a boat.
This is Ali Pritchard, site manager at Monk's House.
The ground floor rooms are almost submerged into the earth and you enter through the conservatory, stepping down to arrive into the dining room. Now, this is a 16th century building. The rooms are small but cosy and every wall is adorned with colourful artwork and furniture. The overwhelming smell at Monk's House, I always think, is books. You can smell books.
The smell of the house is a clue as to who used to live here. And there's another clue, a portrait of the former owner of Monk's House.
This portrait slightly stops you in your tracks. I think it is recognisable as a piece of art, and it definitely, for our visitors, warrants further inspection.
The woman in the painting is the writer Virginia Woolf, who bought Monk's House with her husband Leonard in 1919. The house, in all its rustic simplicity, was a kind of oasis for Virginia, very different to the house she'd grown up in Kensington in London. Born Adeline Virginia Stephen in 1882, Virginia was one of eight siblings, which included half-brothers and sisters.
There was a huge number of children in the house and quite a few servants as well. It was a big house and pretty noisy, I would think, at times.
Art historian and biographer Frances Spaulding.
The family life of the Stephen family must have been extraordinary because a number of guests would come and see their father. He knew people like George Eliot, he was a friend of Charles Darwin, Thomas Hardy, all sorts of literary and scientific people who were well known at the time.
Virginia's father, Leslie Stephen, was himself a writer.
He always liked to write sitting in a rocking chair with a board over his lap. So the business of writing was always going on in the house, and with all these books around and her love of reading, it was perhaps inevitable that she was going to become a writer.
And Virginia showed an early passion for the written word.
Virginia was allowed the run of her father's library, and he was so astonished by the speed at which she read that he said, "Goodness, child, you don't half gobble," meaning that she was gobbling up these books.
Virginia's father died in 1904, and the family, Virginia and four of her siblings, moved to a cheaper neighbourhood of London. It was Virginia's older sister, Vanessa, who was behind the move.
They needed a change, they needed a fresh breath of air, and so she found a house number 46, Gordon Square, in Bloomsbury.
Far from the affluent area of London it's known as today, Bloomsbury at the beginning of the century was a bohemian part of London, thriving with artists, actors and writers. It was home to the Slade School of Art, the recently opened Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, or RADA, and the British Museum.
Their relatives and friends in Kensington were deeply shocked because Kensington was thought to be the sort of best place in London to live for those of certain means and position in life.
Vanessa was an artist, a painter, and she felt at home in Bloomsbury. She immediately set to work modernising the house.
Vanessa Bell painted the walls of certain rooms white, and things looked different and more modern immediately. She flung paisley shawls over the chairs, which gave a lovely sort of sense of colour. It was a different environment to those they'd grown up in.
The family settled in quickly in Bloomsbury, and soon they'd established a small group of writers, artists, economists and philosophers who would meet at Gordon Square to discuss the issues of the day.
Really what these young people were wanting to do was to throw off the restrictions of the Victorian world they'd grown up in.
They became known as the Bloomsbury Group, and their evening gatherings became legendary, attracting everyone from the novelist E.M. Forster to the art critic and post-impressionist painter Roger Fry, as well as the Jewish writer Leonard Wolfe, who Virginia would go on to marry, and the painter Clive Bell, who married Vanessa. Members of the group would descend upon the house to talk and debate everything from art to Britain's declining empire and the nuances of left-leaning politics.
It wasn't just a sort of intellectual discussion that had caused Bloomsbury to come together as a group. It was a recognition that they actually enjoyed each other's company. I mean, Virginia and Vanessa were very strikingly beautiful young women and clearly had an intelligence, both of them, that went beyond what was usual to find in young women of that age because of their background, partly, and because of what they'd inherited. And so there was a specialness to it from the start, I think.
The group remains one of the most talked-about cultural movements of the 20th century, a forum for discussion and friendship, which gave rise to extraordinary works of art and literature.
A clique, it was, really. And cliques are awfully irritating because they make other people feel they're outside the clique. But they were rather special. I mean, the great curiosity about Bloomsbury is that it went on being something of a group and going on meeting and talking until many of them died.
The Bloomsburys also had a major influence on Virginia's own writing style.
Roger Fry was one of the first to understand what she was trying to do when she wrote some experimental short stories. And soon after that, she wrote her first what we call modernist novel, which breaks with the usual traditions of novel writing. She had much greater freedom in the way she played with things, and sometimes in certain books she more or less abandons plot. And she adopts what is often called the stream of consciousness, which allows the narrator to develop a sort of inner story.
Ali Pritchard again.
As early as 1908, she'd boasted, "I shall reform the novel," and she was working on The Voyage Out.
The Voyage Out was Virginia's first novel and was published in 1915. She had, in fact, handed in the manuscript 2 years before, but the strain of finishing the novel had led to a serious breakdown and the publication was paused. Her husband Leonard found a house in Richmond where Virginia could recuperate in peace and quiet away from the hustle and bustle of central London.
One thing he did when she was beginning to get better was to do what they'd earlier talked about, which was to buy a printing press. Now, Leonard had a slight tremble in one, if not both, of his hands, a tremor. So it was Virginia Woolf who had to put the type in the letterpress, which is a tedious and rather difficult business, yes, finding the right letter, getting it in the right position, and Leonard would clean the machine and put the ink in and make sure the paper was in the position and then do the printing. Leonard thought that this composing of the letters would calm Virginia Woolf and take her mind off her writing for a bit and give her a certain rest, mental rest. And it does seem to have actually had that effect.
The Wolves named their printing house after their Richmond home, and the Hogarth Press was launched in 1917. Their first publication was ready in July that year. 150 copies of a book called Two Stories, which, as the name suggests, contained two short stories, Three Jews by Leonard and The Mark on the Wall by Virginia. In 1922, Virginia's third novel, Jacob's Room, became her first novel to be published by Hogarth. Virginia was sensitive to criticism and being able to self-publish freed her from the intense anxiety she felt submitting her work to publishers.
I think Virginia was worried that some of her desires to be more innovative and experimental might not find a sympathetic publisher, and the work would be disfigured by an editor that didn't understand her purposes. So it, quite early on, the fact that the Hogarth Press took over as her publisher was a great relief to her. Once you were going to be your own publisher, you were much freer to write as and how you felt like. So it was very encouraging and gave her greater freedom.
But it wasn't at Hogarth House that Virginia was to write the novels that would establish her as the great writer we know her as today. It was at this unassuming cottage in the middle of the Sussex Downs which the Wolfes bought just after the First World War.
Part of every major novel after 1919 was written at Monk's House.
Monk's House manager Ali Pritchard again.
The success of a day was determined by how many words reached the page. Monk's House, it represented freedom and being alone to write with time at your disposal and freedom to roam the downs.
Once settled at Monk's House, Virginia began to shape the cottage to her needs. Indeed, she paid for many of the numerous modernisations to the house with sales from her books. Mrs. Dalloway, published in 1925, paid for the water closet, and Orlando, published in 1928, the new extension.
So we're going to step in through the garden gate and walk to the back of the property. As you reach the back of the house, the gardens open up before you and immediately you hit upon the village church of St. Peter, which looms over the orchard at the bottom of the garden. And next to it sits the writing lodge under an old chestnut tree.
As well as being remarkable as the place where Virginia Woolf wrote some of the greatest works of English literature, Monk's House is also notable as being home to another great work of art.
To the right are the stairs for the first floor, and there are books stacked on each tread and climbing the walls in the room. As you move to the kitchen, this is when you see the portrait.
The oil on panel portrait of Virginia Woolf sits on the kitchen wall above a music cabinet.
So we're not entirely sure when the portrait was painted. It has a date of circa 1912, possibly a little bit earlier. It's, you know, it's 40 centimetres by about 30 centimetres. It's not a large painting. She's leaning forward with her arms resting on the table and her hands clasped. Her lips are parted as if she is about to speak.
It is, in fact, one of a pair of almost identical portraits painted by two different artists. Frances Spaulding again.
The same time Roger Fry painted this picture, and you can see that it was done at the same time, partly because of the pose and partly because of the clothes that Virginia Woolf is wearing.
The painting is almost exactly the same image. I'd be very surprised if they weren't standing next to each other whilst painting it.
Roger Fry was one of the most multi-talented members of the Bloomsbury set, artist, designer, curator and critic. Virginia once noted that he had more knowledge and experience than the rest of us put together.
It's unfortunately not Roger Fry at his best. It's very clumsy. There's a stiffness to it. He's overworked it in places.
The two portraits depict the same scene, Virginia sitting in a wing chair. So what makes the other portrait, the one which hangs at Monk's House, the more intriguing of the two? Perhaps it has something to do with the fact that the painter of this portrait had a unique bond with Virginia. It was her sister, Vanessa.
What Vanessa Bells has, and perhaps because she was so much more familiar with her sister, is a confident lightness of touch. She's managed to position the facial features exactly right.
during this time period, Vanessa Bell was experimenting with radical ideas in her art and the arrival of post-impressionism to England. She was challenging the tradition of portrait painting, preferring to capture a likeness of someone in the hope of evoking something more.
She's painted very loosely in a lovely kind of pale blue, a slightly darker blue for the blouse that is underneath her jacket, all offset by the warmth of colour in the flesh in her face and neck and in her hands. It's very beautifully judged, this picture. It's a very knowing portrait, handled with great dexterity. The portrait of Virginia Woolf by Roger Fry does convey a sadness, almost a pathetic quality, that is not to be found in the portrait by Vanessa Bell.
Some people jump straight to, oh, she looks so sad, so melancholic. And I don't see that at all. I think it's a really tender portrait, and I think it speaks of the love between two sisters. I like her rounded features in this. She looks healthy, and I do not see anything melancholic in it. Vanessa's portrait, I think, reflects the period when Virginia Woolf was still recovering from a breakdown. And one commentator has pointed out, and I think I share this view, that this painting reflects the protective care and affection of Vanessa for her sister at this time. That's really what I choose to see in the painting.
The sisters had always been close. As children, they set up a family newspaper, the Hyde Park Gate News. Its pages were filled with riddles, poems and diary entries, which talked of going to concerts and their trips to the family home in Cornwall.
They went for at least 3 months, and every year there would be this great packing up of the household, because dogs and servants, the cook, easels, trunks, cricket bats, everything had to be taken by train down to St Ives.
The illustrations in the paper were drawn by Vanessa, and the articles were penned mainly by Virginia. The paper ran for 5 years, but stopped abruptly in 1895. Virginia was 13 at the time, an age which marked the beginning of her lifelong struggle with mental illness. Later on, Monk's House provided a refuge, helping to lift Virginia's mood. She especially loved the garden.
Announcing the purchase of the house to a friend in 1919, Virginia Woolf wrote, "The point of it is the garden. This is going to be the pride of our hearts, I warn you." Later on in September of the same year, she wrote, "We have been planting tiny grains of seed in the front bed, in the pious or religious belief that they will resurrect next spring as Clarkia, Campanula, Larkspur and Scabious. I shan't recognise them if they do. Then there's weeding. Very soon, in any occupation, one makes a game of it. I mean that one gives characters to weeds. The worst is the fine grass, which has to be sifted out conscientiously." Virginia said of the area, "Every direction bears fruit. By opening the garden gate, she could be walking on the downs in minutes. The pleasures of walking are obvious. Virginia adored the landscape, and walking helped her to get the rhythm into her sentences. I like to have space to spread my mind out in," she said.
But as much of a sanctuary as Monk's House was, it couldn't provide a permanent cure.
I think Monk's House certainly helped alleviate her struggles with mental illness. But I do think there was always a conflict between society versus solitude. And at times it was the perfect antidote to a busy London life. But at other times it was almost depressing, especially towards the end of her life.
On the 28th of March 1941, Virginia left Monk's House and walked half a mile to the River Ouse, where she ended her life at the age of 59.
She left some letters behind, saying goodbye to Leonard. She wrote two, actually, for Leonard. One possibly a sort of revision of an earlier one, and one also for Vanessa. one of them ends, I think, that I simply cannot go on anymore. And it was a very decisive sort of step. She analyses and explains what's been happening, how she'd been hearing voices again, didn't want to be a burden on people with a war, during the war and so on. It's a very poignant but to the point letter.
Grasping for consolation, a heartbroken Vanessa later wrote, "One can at least be glad that this did not happen as it so nearly did years ago when all her gifts would have been wasted." Monk's House is the only house of Virginia Woolf's open to the public, a place of almost religious significance to those who love her books.
We have people clutching their chests and almost in tears. You know, for some people, you know, visiting the home of a cherished author is a, you know, dream realised. And where she's an icon, she's also a myth. And Monk's House is a pilgrimage place. In a way, this painting is the altar point for that pilgrimage. So without realising it, we are perpetuating that shrine-like quality, which I don't doubt for a moment both Leonard and Virginia would hate.
Vanessa Bell's portrait is just one of many treasures featured in 125 treasures from the collections of the National Trust, a brand new book of stunning photography and descriptions of the most exciting decorative arts, furniture, books and textiles in our collection, spanning the Roman era to the present day. To learn more about this publication, or to dig deeper into the story of this painting in our web article, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/125pod-writer or follow the link in the show notes. I'm Alison Steadman and this is 125 Treasures, a podcast from the National Trust.